problem of evil, the Bible and science. We talked about creation and evolution. And this is the perfect place for us to talk about the Genesis flood itself. And we'll get to that in just a moment. I remind you that on February the 7th, as we wind this series up, Brother King will be here to talk about plenary inspiration of the Scriptures, the canonization of the Scriptures, and the Apocrypha. And he will be well equipped to deal with that. And so we look forward to Brother King being with us to wind our series of evidences up. Let's talk about the Genesis flood. I want to first begin talking about the importance of the Genesis flood as it pertains to our study of evidences. Thomas Hine said the existence of the flood is denied by evolutionists. Not so much for lack of evidence as because of the necessity of keeping to strict uniformitarianism in order to provide more time for evolution. The evolutionists cannot buy into the concept of universal flood and at the same time hold to their doctrine of uniformitarianism, and we'll redefine that before we're through. There are two models for the geological record. And what we mean by that is, as you look at the geological record, there is the model that interprets everything in light of uniformitarianism, which is what? Well, it says basically that there has been uniformity in all natural, physical, and geological events, and that what you see is explained by gradual changes over billions of years. Assumption is what builds this doctrine of uniformitarianism. So as you look at the geological record, it is all explained by uniformitarianism, they say. On the other side is the concept of catastrophism, which would be things like the worldwide flood, something that is cataclysmic, something that involves sudden burial and rapid sedimentation that we've talked about in the matter of creation and the matter of the flood already, and we'll talk about more in our study this evening. So as you look at the geological record, and we'll talk some about that, that's not going to be the main focal point of our study tonight, but as you look at that, those are the two models that make their interpretation of what you see. Either it was based upon the evolutionary thought, or there was something catastrophic that took place, such as the worldwide flood. Dr. Thompson said that the flood is incompatible with evolution. Listen to what he says. It would be difficult to find an account in any period of biblical history that has been ridiculed more frequently and with greater derisiveness than the story of the flood. Such a response from those who do not believe in God hardly is surprising, since by all accounts the concept of a recent global flood, by recent he's talking about in time as far as thousands of years versus millions or billions of years, that's what he means by a recent flood, is incompatible with the naturalistic system of origins espoused by the unbelievers. For more than 100 years, the flood has been under accelerated attack by infidels within the scientific community who have chosen to support such concepts as uniformitarianism or organic evolution. In fact, atheistic writers have admitted that the one main force behind the rise of uniformitarianism was the desire to eliminate God as creator and the initiator of the Great Flood. Well, Thompson is right about that. The flood is incompatible with the concept of evolution. So we need to understand something about what the Bible says about the flood. Let's begin with the Bible story, which is recorded in Genesis 6-9, and I encourage you to get your Bible, and let's open to the book of Genesis, and let's get the biblical account, and then we're going to look at more evidence a little later on that the biblical account indeed is true, starting with the New Testament, giving us evidence of that. So we're going to not read every account of everything about the flood, but it's recorded in Genesis 6-9, and most of us are familiar in general terms with the flood. Let's list some things we know about the flood and the flood story. Let's start with Genesis 6, the reason for the flood. The reason for the flood was the wickedness of man, beginning at verse 5, that the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thought of his heart was on evil continually. Well, I won't read verses 7, 8, and 9, but verses 5 and 6 suggest for us that the flood came because God saw that the world was given to wickedness, and man's intent was on evil continually, and so it said he was sorry that he had made man. That is, he had regretted that he had made man, and therefore he was going to destroy it by a flood. Now let's notice beginning at verse 14, God gave instructions to Noah for the building of the ark and making preparation for the flood. For example, there is, in verse 14, you're an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, that is, compartments in the ark. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Inside and out, you cover it with pitch. The size, we'll come back to that a little later, are 300 cubits. The length will be 300 cubits, and its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. We'll translate that into feet in just a few moments. But beginning then at verse 16, the making of the window and the door in the side, And then later the instruction is how many animals that he was to take, two of each kind, male and female, and then that they were to take themselves into the ark. And verse 22 ends that section by saying, thus Noah did, that is, he did according to what God had commanded, so he did. Noah did exactly what God said. So here's the instruction for building the ark. He has a year to build that ark, and he makes the preparation for the flood. Now, beginning at chapter 7, Noah and his family, there are a total of 8 people, and the animals enter into the ark. And so he took animals, some of he took of 7, and more than just the 2 that were mentioned earlier, perhaps for sacrifice. We'll say more about that perhaps a little bit later. And in verse 6 we read that Noah was 600 years old when the waters came upon the earth and they entered into the ark, the text tells us, continuing down through verse 16, and took every animal that God had instructed him to take into the ark. Now they're in the ark. Now let's talk a little more, beginning at verse 4, verse 12, verse 17, talking about the rain upon the earth. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights, mentioned 3 times in the text. Verse 4, that it rained 40 days and 40 nights. Verse 12, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. And again at verse 17, if you care to mark those. So God caused it to rain upon the earth 40 days and for 40 nights. Now this is interesting because at verse 11, the text says, the fountains of the deep were broken up. The fountains, the springs, burst forth like in volcanic fashion. So the fountains of the deep, not just that there was the rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, but the fountains of the deep began to burst forth as in volcanic fashion, bursting forth water from beneath and from above as well. And so there's where the water comes from both sources, according to verse 11. Now, I want you to notice at verse 20, the depth of the flood. The water prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. That is, the mountains were covered. I take that to mean that the mountains, the top of the mountain was covered by 22.5 feet. So if you can imagine 22.5 feet above the top of the mountains, that's pretty good depth. To give you kind of a perspective, from this level of the floor, not in the back of the auditorium because we have a slope, but from this level, right in front of the Lord, in front of this podium, to the ceiling, 16 feet. Well, that's a long way, 22.5 feet, if you can imagine. Above the top of the mountains. That's how deep the flood was. Let us go a little further and talk about, verse 21 tells us that all flesh died. That was the design of the flood. That all flesh died that moved on the earth, the birds and the cattle and the beast and every creeping thing that crept up on the earth and every man. So everything that took breath into its nostrils, God caused it to die in the flood, the text says. Now at verse 24, we begin to see how long did all of this last. Well, verse 24 said, the water prevailed upon the earth for 150 days. Starting in the next chapter, chapter 8, the waters began to decrease then. But they're not out of the ark yet. According to chapter 8, verses 13 to 17, Noah and his family, 13 to 19, Noah and his family came out a year later. In the 601st year of the life of Noah, he came out of the ark. Now that's just a synopsis of what took place in the flood. In this worldwide flood, and we'll give evidence that it was more than just a local flood in a moment. Now this gives us kind of a perspective of what took place over a period of a little over a year. This is Wiersbe's chronology. And these numbers over here represent the month. In the second month and the 10th day, they entered the ark, according to chapter 7. Just a week later, the rains began to start, according to verse 11. The rain stopped on the 3rd month, in the 26th day of that month. The ark rested on Mount Ararat in the 7th month. So from the 2nd month to the 7th month, they're in the ark, and they rest upon the Mount Ararat, chapter 8. The 10th month, in the 1st day, the top of the mountains were seen. In the 11th month and the 11th day, they sent out the raven and the dove. In the just 7 days later, the dove returned. And the 25th of the month of that same month, the dove did not return. Then Noah removed the cover in the first month of the next year, in the 601st year of his life. And they left the ark in the 2nd month and the 27th day. So for a little over a year, they were in the ark with all of the animals in the ark. That gives us a little time span of what's taking place. And let's talk about the size of the ark. One of the objections of those who follow the uniformitarianism or the evolutionary thought and the atheistic concept, they say the flood was just a myth, it didn't happen, and whatever did happen was a localized phenomena. And another thing that they add is the ark wasn't big enough to house all the animals. Well, the ark was 450 foot in length. Go back to verse 15, and if you don't have it written out in the margin of your text, this may be a good time to do that. And I'm basing that upon 18 inches per cubic. Some go by 7.5. So if you find somebody else's numbers that say the ark was a little shorter or a little longer, they're basing that upon either 19 inches or maybe it's 21 inches. But the most common is 18, and that's what we're following here. So that translates into 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Now, some people have a problem getting those numbers and getting a perspective in their mind, so we'll give you a little idea of how that works. 450 feet long is 150 yards. That's a football field and a half long. That's how long it was. Well, what about the size in comparison to other things? Well, this is 175th scale that someone has built of the ark. This is a railroad car that the standard stock car for the railroad industry is, by comparison, the size. This is one of Columbus's ship, Pinta, by comparison. They are both 175th scale. To give you kind of a perspective of the size of the ark. Now, that's going to be important when we talk about the number of animals that they put in just a few moments. It was 45 feet high. From the ground underneath this till you reach the peak of this auditorium is 45 feet tall. There were three levels within the ark. To give you a perspective how far, 75 feet wide, this is the original plans that have been altered, that goes from this wall to inside that classroom on the other side is 76 feet. So if you can imagine looking at this from inside those classrooms, take that wall away, and then you have that classroom, we're at 76 feet. That gives you kind of a perspective of the size of the ark. Well, there was plenty of room in the ark for the animals that were needed and for the things that they had to have. John Whitcomb, who in his book, The World That Perished, you may recognize Whitcomb of the Morrison Whitcomb's notable book, The Genesis Flood. He said, for the sake of realism, imagine waiting at a railroad crossing while 10 freight trains, each pulling 52 boxcars, move slowly by one after the other. We'll go back to this quote. You stop and think about that. You're setting a railroad crossing, and here comes a train that has 52 cars. And here comes another train, 52 cars. And then here comes a third one, and then a fourth one, and then a fifth one, and a sixth, and then a seventh, and an eighth, and a ninth, and a tenth. That's a lot of railroad cars. That's how much space would be available in the ark, for its capacity would be equivalent of 520 modern railroad stock cars. A barge of such gigantic size, with its thousand of built-in compartments, mentioned in chapter 6 and verse 14, we'll call attention to that when we pass by, would have been sufficiently large to carry two of every species of air-breathing animal in the world today, and doubtless the tendency toward taxonomic splitting, that is, produce more species than are justified by the Genesis kind. We talked earlier about the kinds and species are not equivalent. They reproduce after their kind, not by species. We talked about that in our creation study. That only half of the available deck space would be needed, is his point. Whitcomb said, well, if you take the amount of space, if you took the two of every kind, you don't need as much space as was found in the ark. So what do we need with the rest of the space? Well, the remaining space, he said, would be for Noah and his family to occupy, five additional representatives of each comparatively few kind that were acceptable for sacrifice, that is, when they took seven, and two of each kind would have become extinct since after the flood and the food for them all. And his point is, there was plenty of size and plenty of space for all of the animals, contrary to what our evolutionary friends may say. Well, that's the Bible story of the flood. Now, let's raise the question, was it a universal flood or was it a local flood? Those who acknowledge there had to be a flood, there was a flood of some sort. And even some of the theistic evolutionists who argue that I believe the Bible is true and I believe the Bible account is true, but they tell us that this was a local flood. Some of our own brethren argued that. And if I name some of those who taught that, they've argued that this perhaps was a local flood and not a universal flood. It's trying to harmonize the time scale that the evolutionists need of the billions of years with the account of the Bible is the effort. Now, here's the idea that some have had. It's argued that the flood was limited to the Mesopotamian region, that there was a flood, that there was a Noah, he built an ark, he put animals therein, but it was only because of a localized flood, but it wasn't a universal flood that covered the whole earth. And so then, we do not have, as we look at the geological record, we cannot explain the things that you see by something that was catastrophic. It'll be explained by uniformitarianism. And so you see how the evolutionists try to harmonize those. Now, I understand some of this may be, you get lost in some of the quotations, but this is important, I think, to establish our point. The flood and the old earth concept cannot coexist. This is Dr. Henry Morris, who's written much on the Genesis flood and creation, and a part of the Institute for Creation Research. He said the biblical flood in the days of Noah has become a great divide between two watersheds of belief. On the one hand, there are those who say that it's either purely mythological event or as possibly a local regional flood. These groups include practically all evolutionists. It also includes some old earth creationists, theistic evolutionists, in other words. These all accept the so-called geological ages, billions of years in other words, as approved by the record of early earth, recognizing that global hydraulic cataclysm would have destroyed any evidence of such geological ages. Now listen to what he says. The geological ages concept and a worldwide devastating flood logically cannot coexist. On the other hand, he says, the young creationists accept the biblical record of the flood and the literal record of tremendous cataclysm involving not only a worldwide flood, but also a great upheaval and volcanic outpouring completely, and I won't read all the rest of the quotation, but he said, what he's saying is you cannot take the geological timetable that some have given of billions of years and harmonize that with the global flood. You can't do that. They just don't go hand in hand. They have to tell us then their way of getting around the universal or the catastrophic flood is to say it was a localized phenomenon. So let's open our text once and again, and let's see from the text that it was a universal flood. Starting with Genesis chapter 8 and in verse 9, this was not a local flood that only flooded a local region or even just one nation, but it was a universal flood. Chapter 8 and in verse 9. Chapter 8 and verse 9, the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Notice that the dove found no resting place for the sole of her feet, and she returned to the ark to him, for the waters on the face of the whole earth. The waters on the face of the whole earth, not a portion of the earth, not in the region of Mesopotamia, but upon the whole earth. Let's back up to chapter 6 and verse 7. In chapter 6, God's design for the flood, that he might destroy man, not from Mesopotamia, but from the earth. He's going to destroy man from the earth, verse 7. Let's go to verse 13 of chapter 6. God is going to destroy all flesh with the earth. Notice at the end of verse 13, that I will destroy them, that is all flesh, with the earth. Does that sound like a localized phenomena, or does it sound like a universal flood? Let's go to verse 17 of the same text. Every living thing in the earth is going to be destroyed. Look at verse 17. That I'll bring the flood waters on the earth to destroy from under it all flesh, which is in the breath of life, and which is the breath of life, and everything which is on the earth shall die. Everything on the earth shall die. Sounds like a universal flood, doesn't it? Let's go to chapter 7, if you will, and in verse 4. Chapter 7 and verse 4, after 7 days I will cause it to rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. Now, if he destroys that in the region of Mesopotamia, then that statement is not true. Well, look at verse 19. Verse 19 says that all the high hills were under the whole earth were covered. All the high hills of the whole earth were covered. Well, if it was just the mountains of Mesopotamia that were covered, then all the high hills of the whole earth were not covered. So that statement isn't true. Well, let's come on to verse 21 of the same text. Every creeping thing and every man was going to be destroyed in that flood, according to verse 21. Let's go to chapter 9. The fact that God gave a rainbow as a covenant that he would not again do what he did in this flood argues for a universal flood. How so? A rainbow is saying God's not going to do that again. If it was a local flood, there have been many local floods. There have been large floods in a particular region that have flooded and killed people and animals and all that's living within that region. So the rainbow means nothing then because God did again what he said he wouldn't do if it was only a local flood. But God never has again done a universal worldwide flood as we saw in Genesis chapter 6. Now, if it was a local flood, then why build the ark? Good question, isn't it? If there was a local flood, why did God have Noah to build the ark? Why didn't Noah and the animals just migrate? Why didn't they just do that? Why do you need to build an ark, spend 100 years getting people ready and build this gigantic ark if it's only going to be a localized flood? Didn't Noah in 100 years have time to travel a good distance on the earth? Surely he would have. If so, then what promise is in the rainbow? There is no promise in the rainbow. And if so, then God's purpose of destruction of every land creature was not accomplished because there were land creatures that were in the other parts of the earth that were not destroyed. It was not a local flood. It was a universal, worldwide flood. Let's move to a third thing, and let's talk about the evidence of the flood. What kind of evidence can be cited there was a flood? That indeed the Genesis account is true. And I want to start with the New Testament now, and let's talk about Jesus endorsing the Genesis flood. This is very, very important. And this is where I would start if I were going to argue with somebody who denied that the Genesis account is true. I would start with the resurrection of Christ. And we'll come to the resurrection a little bit later. But here's what we would point out. That Jesus was proven to be the Son of God, that is deity, by the resurrection from the dead. We'll give evidence of the resurrection and the empty tomb being evidence, the strongest of evidence, in our study a little bit later. But Romans 1 and verse 4 says he was declared to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead. Now we can prove that he was raised from the dead, so we prove that he is indeed the Son of God. We've already noticed that Jesus endorsed the creation account in Matthew chapter 19. He endorsed the creation account, which means that he endorsed the book of Genesis. So I can have confidence in the Genesis record because Jesus said what was said in Genesis 1 and 2 was a true story. He endorsed that account. Can I believe Genesis 1 and 2, but I can't believe Genesis 6 to 9? I have to accept Genesis 6 to 9 just like I do Genesis 1 and 2. So Jesus endorsed the Genesis record. But Jesus also endorsed the story of the Genesis flood. Let's notice two examples of that if you care to note those. In Matthew chapter 24, in describing the destruction of Jerusalem, in Matthew chapter 24, we'll just give reference to it. But you might mark and note Luke 17 says essentially the same thing. Now it's not the parallel account to Matthew 24, by the way, but it is parallel in principle. In Matthew chapter 24, beginning at verse 36, but of that day, that is when the end of time will come, verse 35, knoweth no man, know not the angels in heaven, but my Father only. Now verse 37, as it was in the days of Noah, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. For in the days before the flood, there was a flood, Jesus said. They were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. There was an ark. And did not know until the flood came and took them away, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Now what Jesus just did in Matthew chapter 24 and Luke 17 was endorse that account. Jesus was proved to be the Son of God by the resurrection. So when I see evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead, that gives me evidence that this is a true story in Genesis 6 to 9. How do I know it's true? Jesus said it was true. And when you tell your friend that is an atheist or your professor that's an atheist and you tell them that the empty tomb proves that, he probably doesn't know what to do with the empty tomb. Probably doesn't know what to do with the manuscript evidence of the resurrection of Christ. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But let's talk about some other evidences. It could be cited that indeed the Genesis account is true. Let's talk about the geologic findings. Is there evidence that we can point to that say, hey, this proves that there was a worldwide catastrophic event, most likely the worldwide flood that caused this? There is some caution. Bert Thompson says, and I won't read the entire quote, he said, I believe a word of caution is in order. In the past, extremes have been documented on both sides of the issue. What does he mean by that? Well, he said that some have made indefensible statements like there's no way the geologically of supporting the idea of a worldwide flood. And he's quoting from John Clayton. John Clayton was one of those institutional preachers that finally went off on the deep end of saying basically there's millions and millions of years in Genesis chapter 1, and he denied a worldwide flood. And there's no way of supporting in the geological record of a flood. There's no evidence of that at all. On the other end of the spectrum, there are those who basically try to pick out a particular layer and say, this here was caused by the flood. And Thompson is warning that we need to avoid both extremes of that. And while we need to avoid those extremes, there is some evidence that could be cited with reference to the flood. Dr. Gertler said, and that the catastrophic event, or any catastrophic event, is going to leave some evidence behind. He said these two great events, and what he was talking about in the context was the separation of the waters from the firmament in Genesis 1 and 2, and then the flood of Genesis 6. Those two events would have probably involved massive tectonic plate shifts, volcanic activity, ensuing millions of tons of sedimentary deposition. The consequences would be the rapid layering that is seen in the geological column, along with multitudes of fossils and vast stores of coal from the compression, and many cubic miles of organic material, such as animals and vegetation. What his point is, if there was a catastrophic event like a flood, there would be some evidence left behind. Somewhere there would be some evidence of that. And he's right about that. Let's talk about some of those evidences that Gertler points out himself. What he refers to as the Karoo supergroups in Africa. And this is in the Karoo Valley in South Africa. And this is from his book, Unraveling Evolution. This is located amidst the Karoo supergroups. That it contains some 800 billion rapidly buried vertebrate animals. that could only be accounted for by some catastrophic occurrence. Was that the worldwide flood? His point is, it very well could be. That seems to be the only explanation you could have for some 800 billion rapidly buried animals there in South Africa. He gives another example. In California, the Miocene shales in California, there's 1 billion fish fossilized within 4 square miles. Again, only something of a catastrophic, cataclysmic nature could account for that kind of thing. Was it the worldwide flood? Most likely it was. But here is some evidence of something catastrophic taking place rather than the concept of uniformitarianism. Those who believe in evolution can't account for that. Well, let's give another. Fossils in the top of the mountains. For example, there are fossils like those that are pictured on the screen before you that have been found in the Himalayas of Nepal. How could marine fossils be found in the top of the mountains? Well, let me give you a quotation from Dr. Thompson. He said, geologic evidence suggests that most, if not all, of the world's mountains have been underwater at some point in the past. The conclusion is demanded by the evidence of sedimentary deposits and marine fossils at or near their summits. Much of the Earth's crust is composed of sedimentary rocks such as shales and limestone and sandstone that are generally known to form underwater. See, there's evidence in the top of the mountain. These mountains have been underwater somewhere. Well, Genesis 6 said they were. By 22 and a half feet at least. Is that evidence of the flood? Perhaps it is. The rapid sedimentation would seem to give us some evidence that indeed there was a worldwide flood. Now, you've looked at this evidence, so I'm going to go through this quickly. As we talked about the age of the earth, again, quoting from Dr. Gertler, he talks about the contemporary rapid sedimentation gives evidence of some catastrophic event. It argues for a young earth. But he talks about how some of the layers that are supposedly created millions of years apart, that's that doctrine of uniformitarianism. I won't read you the entire quotation, but some of those layers that are supposed to be millions of years in difference in age are intermingled with one another. An example of that is right here in the Grand Canyon, wherein the Cambrian and the Mississippian are interbedded one with the other. And how'd they get out of order if the doctrine of uniformitarianism be true? Only something catastrophic and cataclysmic is explaining that. Is that evidence of the worldwide flood? These men, Dr. Patton, Steve Rudd, and Dr. Gertler think so. Again, here's Dr. Gertler's in his work, The Rapid Sedimentation, that the layers of the geologic column formed rapidly rather than slowly. There's evidence that it happened very slowly. For example, he said, why are there dinosaurs that are found without their vegetation in the fossil record? Why is that the case? If it was something that happened over millions of years in a very slow process, that suggests that there is a rapid, some kind of rapid burial and rapid sedimentation. We gave this picture. We talked about the age of the earth. This is found right over here at Cookeville, Tennessee. A fossilized tree that begins in one layer of coal and goes through numerous layers and then into another bed of coal. Dr. Gertler has said only a rapid catastrophic burial could create such pristine preservation. That is suggesting of something catastrophic and a rapid burial of the tree rather than millions of years and billions of years of burying that. That seems to argue for some kind of concept of a universal worldwide flood. Again, I'm not going to read the entire quotation. Dr. Thompson talks about fossilized evidence of rapid burial and disorder. That is, the rapid burial of the fossils. And also the disorder of that. That if it happens over millions and billions of years, there ought to be some system of order where this layer comes and then this layer. But what ought to be down in this layer sometimes appears up in a higher layer. And what ought to be in the higher layer sometimes is down in the lower layer. That suggests something catastrophic, such as a worldwide flood. Let's talk about flood legends. This is interesting to talk about flood legends. Byron Nelson in the Deluge Story in Stone said the existence among all races of stories are traditions of the great flood which destroyed all mankind has long been known and regarded for those familiar with them as remarkable in confirmation of the truth of the Deluge account in Genesis. What he's saying is in every community, in every tribe, in every village, and in every country, just about, there is some legend about a flood. More evidence of that. Let's talk about that. Alfred Rewinkle, I suppose is how you pronounce his name, in The Flood, his book on the flood, said, traditions similar to those recorded in are found among nearly all nations and tribes of the human race. And it's he goes on to talk about it. It's a concept that seemingly was passed down from one generation to another and the basis of some religious observance. But every tribe and every community and every nation has some legend of the flood. Well, back to Byron Nelson. This is a little graph from his book. And you can't read all the details of this, but over here we have the list of the things that took place in the flood that we went through a few moments ago, such as man being in sin, the divine destruction, that God favored a particular family. There was the building of the ark, that there were humans that were saved, there were animals that were saved, there were animals that were destroyed, universal destruction, landing the ark upon a mountain, birds were sent out, survivors worshiped, and etc. But here are the nations wherein those are found, such as Assyrian and Babylonia, the Persian and Syria, and Asia Minor, and Greece and Egypt and Italy and Russia and China and India and Peru and Hawaii and on down. There's just various nations where that's found. Now, these little blocks represent either full representation of the biblical idea or at least a partial representation of that. There may be kind of a perverted story, but there is some kind of similarity between the legends of a flood in nearly every nation. How could that be if the account never happened? These legends stretch from China to Babylon to Mexico to Egypt to Sudan and Indonesia and Romania. Listen to this from the Tornado in the Junkyard reference to the relentless myth of Darwinism. In 95% or more than 200 flood legends, the flood was worldwide. This is kind of categorizing them by percentage. In 88%, a certain family was favored. In 70%, survival by means of a boat. In 67%, animals were saved. In 66%, the flood was due to wickedness of man. In 66%, the survivors had been forewarned. In 57%, they ended up on a mountain. 35%, the birds were sent out, etc. And in 9%, exactly 8 people were spared. Now, that argues for something about the validity of the story when nearly every nation who are not even religious, may not even know anything about the Bible, have a legend or a story of a flood somewhere. That argues for the fact of the worldwide flood. Now, let's close by talking about the flood explains and it answers some things. The flood explains and answers a lot of things. It gives us an explanation for the geological phenomenon. What do we mean by that? Well, Roger Dickens in The Fall of Unbelief, I've quoted several times from him in the series, he talks about this writer, talking about himself, contends that the Genesis flood of Genesis 6 to 8 is an adequate answer for the geological phenomena as we observe it today. In fact, most of the paleontological and geological phenomena that we see today can be explained in light of a cataclysmal geology, that is, fossils and strata were formed by sudden burial and sedimentation, and not by a slow process of uniformitarianism. And that is, when we see like that tree that we saw a minute ago, we see a rapid burial of the dinosaurs without their vegetation. How do you explain that? You can't explain it by uniformitarianism. The worldwide Genesis flood gives an explanation for the geological phenomenon. It gives us an explanation of what happened to dinosaurs. Here's the evolutionist explanation thereof. They're not all in agreement. Some say it was by sudden climate change. That is, there wasn't a universal flood, remember. And so what happened to them was there was a sudden climate change and they couldn't survive. And that took millions or billions of years for that to happen. Some have, strangely enough, but if you can believe in the Big Bang theory and the ape-man concept, you could believe in this, that an asteroid 6 miles wide impacted the Earth and caused dust and soot to block the sun rays, and therefore it caused all kinds of problems for the animals, and then they died out, basically, is what happened to them. Well, there was a massive disease that wiped them out, some say. And there was a volcanic greenhouse effect, so that they all died out. Now, in response to that, why did an asteroid kill every dinosaur but left other forms of life unharmed? That was strange, isn't it? And then why did the asteroid not kill all other reptiles, such as turtles and alligators, etc.? And there's nothing in the fossil record to support that idea that all the dinosaurs died at once. Looked like they'd all be in the same layer, wouldn't it? Wouldn't you think? If the doctrine of uniformitarianism is true, they'd all be in the same layer, you would think. Now, everyone agrees that there was something catastrophic or sudden that accounts for the fossil, has to account for the fossil record. The asteroid, they say. Here's the creation explanation of what happened to the creationist explanation. The flood explains a lot of what happened to the dinosaur. Do we believe in dinosaurs? Absolutely. Do we believe dinosaurs lived on the earth? Absolutely. You can't read about God's creation and the evidence for dinosaurs and not believe there were dinosaurs and that dinosaurs and man existed together at times. That's another study within itself. But the flood explains that. It was a global flood. as we've already noticed in chapter 7, verse 9, explains the sudden death in the massive fossil graveyards of the dinosaurs. So what happened to the dinosaurs? Many of them were destroyed in the flood. Some of them may have been preserved in the ark and died later. How so? Well, let's analyze that for a moment. Some may have survived in the ark. God took two of every kind, not species. We've already drawn that distinction in Genesis chapter 6. How could they have been in the ark? How was it possible that you could have a dinosaur in the ark? Remember, the ark was huge, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high, could hold 520 modern railroad boxcars. And so it had great capacity, is what I want us to see. But let's add to that the fact that not all dinosaurs were massive. Not all dinosaurs were massive. This is Kyle Butts from What Happened to Dinosaurs. He's with Apologetics Press. To some, the idea of dinosaurs on the ark seems absurd. However, it's not hard to accept the idea of dinosaurs on the ark when you consider carefully the following. Number one, he said, remember that God's creator of all animals and knew exactly how big to build the ark. So if God wanted to preserve some of the dinosaurs, he knew exactly how big to build the ark. Secondly, he said, contrary to popular opinion, not all dinosaurs were massive. We'll so come back to that in just a second. And so, thirdly, he said, God could have allowed Noah to take baby dinosaurs. And baby dinosaurs, he said, would not have taken up much more than the average-sized dog. And so God could have allowed him to take baby dinosaurs. Could there have been dinosaurs on the ark? Certainly so. And they could have been spared and then died later somehow. One explanation of that. I'm not going to bore you with this quotation, but just give you evidence that you might want to consider this. In the Creation Research Institute for Creation Research, they have a long article, an article of Brian Thomas that deals with a study that finds the models are too thick. And what he argues for is the fact that the concept of the dinosaurs being massive, that he's convinced they're not as massive. They were not as massive as we first thought they were. But it is that doctrine of evolution, and those who argue for evolution want to keep them as massive, and so that they say that they couldn't exist with man, so that they fit that into the timetable that they have to have. And he's saying that simply evidence is that they were not near as massive as we thought they were. And so perhaps they were smaller. And they could have fit on the ark. At least some of them could have fit on the ark. And I'll give you that article if you want to read that in your own time. Others were perhaps driven to extinction. How so? Well, there was a climate change after the flood. Even people died at younger ages after the flood. That's one change that took place. You notice before the flood, there was longevity of life. And after the flood, there wasn't. Seemed to be a change in man's lifespan after the flood. And so, it could be the climate change after the flood caused some of that. The earth was filled with humans, and perhaps they hunted and killed some, as they did other animals. They were even eaten by mammals, though that was not thought to be true by some evolutionists. Dinosaurs were found in 2005. It was reported that villagers digging in China's rich fossil beds uncovered and preserved remains of a tiny dinosaur in the belly of a mammal. A startling discovery for scientists who long believed that early mammals couldn't possibly have attacked and eat a dinosaur. That's as late as 2005. Well, I know that's a hurried look at some of that. We cannot do justice to the Genesis flood in one study. We couldn't do justice to the Genesis flood in 15 studies. There's that much material on the story of the Genesis flood and evidence for the Genesis flood. All we're trying to do is just give just a brief synopsis of how this fits with the story and the concept of evidence for our faith. We've looked at the Bible story. We've raised the question, was it a universal flood or was it a localized phenomenon? We gave evidence for the flood, and it gives explanation for some of our questions and some of our problems. Now, we'll follow up with a question that's appeared in our young adult classroom, as we've been doing, and we'll do that when our services are dismissed. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. You believe Jesus to be the Christ, the Son of the living God. Would you repent of your sins and acknowledge your faith in Christ and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?